It's always a pleasure to sit under the sun in Southern California, and we have a New Yorker who has joined us today. He's Casey Allen, who started doing some work in radio way back in the olden days, in 1946.
Right.
Welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to have you with us. Casey, you appeared in such programs as, actually, were you on the very last broadcast of Ma Perkins?
Yes, I was, indeed. In fact, I took some pictures of it. I still have in
have
New
you?
York. Yeah.
That was that. What kind of a day was that for the members of the cast? The final broadcast, when Virginia Payne said, this is it, and she listed the cast members, and she said, this person has played mm-hmm. this role for so many years, and so forth and so on, and she said, I'd love to hear from you. If you're right, I'll try to answer. What kind of a day was that for you and the others in the cast?
Well, it really, the effect of being the last day, most of the people had been on Ma Perkins in Chicago, mm-hmm. where it had started.
Yeah.
And I think I was kind of an interloper. I was the only New York actor in the cast at that point. And Charlie Eggleston and Campbell and there were five or six of them. But the feeling in the cast was they were such a family that it wasn't as if they were ending anything. It was just as if it was another phase in their lives.
Uh-huh.
There was very little sentiment about the length of the run. Of course, Virginia had started out as Ma Perkins when she was in Chicago, and she was probably in her 20s. And she'd grown into the part that by the time the show finished, she looked like Ma Perkins.
But yeah, right.
All of her life, uh-huh. she'd had to make up when she made the appearances for Oxydol and P&G and so forth. She had to put on makeup to look like Ma Perkins. And finally, when we finished the show, she was Ma Perkins.
That last show actually was probably recorded sometime in advance of its final broadcast date, wasn't it?
No.
Were you doing live?
In those days, we did live shows, yes.
Even in the 60s?
Yes, uh-huh. We were doing live shows.
Wow.
And we rehearsed the thing. We had a director who believed in rehearsal.
Uh-huh.
And we'd done the show long enough so that really we could pick up the scripts and do it almost at sight. But he had to rehearse it, and we would go over it and over it and over it, and we practically had it memorized by the time we went on the air. Because the wonderful thing in radio in those days, the people had been in it so long that you really could do a show at sight, and we'd have people run over from one show to another, where someone would do maybe six or eight shows in a day. They'd have a standby, and the standby would read the rehearsal, and then just before we went on the air, the person would rush in, they would hand them a script that they had marked with whatever appropriate markings were necessary and do it cold on the air. In fact, one of the things was kind of fun. Orson Welles was in radio in New York.
Mm-hmm.
And at one point, he was a great prankster. So on this particular show, they were all ready to go on the air. And Orson Welles, and they looked around for Orson Welles, and just at that moment, the doors of the studio flew open, and they pushed him in on a gantry on one of these rolling stretchers, and they rolled him up to the microphone as he started talking. Nothing wrong with him. He just did it as a gag. He did it. He pulled another one on him. Another time, he got up to the microphone, and he was all set to go on the air, and just as the director threw the cue to him, Morrison dropped his script on the floor. Pages all over the floor of the studio. The director nearly had a heart attack, and Orson pulled another script out of his pocket and hit the line on the cue. Well, we had a lot of pranksters, I tell you, in those days.
Well, I've heard lots of stories about scripts being set on fire and things of that
nature. Oh, sure.
Did that really happen?
Oh, yes. And another one that they did, a little more along that line, I think it was Bart Robinson. And he was on the air, and he had this long speech. And two of the guys in the show undid his trousers and dropped his trousers around his ankles while he was. And he didn't miss a line, and he finished the script. And he finally, very casually, said thank you and pulled it in the pants and walked out of the studio. Oh, we had a lot of those.
We have in the past had many opportunities to talk with people whose radio careers began in Chicago and moved out to the West Coast here mm-hmm. in California, or whose career mostly was on the West Coast, but not very often to talk with people who were in radio in New York. And mm-hmm. it must have been very exciting in New York in those 1940s, right?
Mm-hmm. It was a lot of...
Hmm? Go ahead.
Well, the one of the things that happened, of course, we overlapped in radio and television.
Mm-hmm.
And I did a audition at Ruth Roth and Ryan for a show, mm-hmm. and read the script, and the gal said, that's good. The show will be so-and-so. So I started leave. She said, you better take the script. I thought, okay, this is a strange business, and radio, who the hell needs a script? But take the script with you. So I took the script with me and left it at home or something, went to the studio. It turned out to be a television show. I didn't know it was television. I hadn't learned any lines, and I was playing Abraham Lincoln. So while they put on makeup, I had to have the hat, the shawl, and the scene was in a rocking chair. And so while they put on makeup, I learned my lines. And fortunately, I had enough experience that I could learn them. But that was my first TV show, playing Abraham Lincoln. I thought it was going to be radio. So that's how I made my transition.
You had to ad-lib the Gettysburg Address or something.
Wouldn't have been able to do that. But that was the way radio and television
began. Yeah, there was an overlapping late
40s. That overlap, yeah.
Now, among the other radio shows on which you appeared, what were some of those broadcasts?
Well, there was Rosemary, that I did the lead opposite Kermit Bloomgarden's mm-hmm. wife, actually, who was a Broadway producer. Hilltop House, the gal named Jan Miner, who did the Palm Olive commercials for so long.
Madge, the manicure.
Sure, Madge. Yeah. Road of Life was another one. Gangbusters. Goodness.
Well, you didn't play any wanted criminals in Gangbusters, did you?
No, but on Pepper Young's Family, I played a sleazy butler. The director said I was a natural heavy, so he always cast me as a butler from then on. You know. They said, as a matter of fact, they felt that I was really a heavy, that I wasn't mm-hmm. a leading man. So I got a reputation. I always did the bad guys. So that was more fun.
Well, I'm listening to your voice, and I think you could have been a leading man. That voice has leading man qualities.
Oh, I appreciate your
sure.
Actually, what I did, I kind of segued into more announcing.
Did you?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I got into a lot of that, and that was actually the commercials, because with radio, as an actor, that was fine, but you always had to bolster your income a little mm-hmm. bit. So the commercials became very, very important, and narration and voiceovers and things like that.
In radio, were you were, I guess, a freelancer. You were
yes.
not under contract to any network
right.
or station. So you then had the opportunity to work at NBC and CBS.
Worked
and
at all of
Mutual.
Them.
Did some
yeah.
things at Mutual.
Well, it was WR Mutual,
yeah, yeah.
ABC, NBC, CBS. In fact, I did so many shows at CBS, they thought I was on staff there after a while. Because you pick up your check at CBS, you go up into the office there. And then, of course, we worked on the little station. It was WNEW, WPAT, all of the stations around mm-hmm. there. So as freelance, you could cover all of them, hit them all.
What was the radio role that you had that is most lasting in your mind, the one that you did?
Well, Ma Perkins.
Ma Perkins.
Yeah, I played Dr. White on that mm-hmm. for 5 years. And then they wanted me back again. They finished Dr. White, so they created a role of an attorney, and I was on that for the rest of the time of the show.
In that case, in that situation, now I would assume that you, I shouldn't assume this, but did you use the same voice for both the doctor and the attorney?
Well, it's pretty hard to change your voice. It's an attitude more than anything else.
Uh-huh.
So that people were really not aware that I was the same person.
They would no one would recognize that.
Evidently, they didn't, uh-huh. and no one really recognized it.
I wonder if today we listen to tapes of the radio shows,
mm-hmm.
and you can hear as we're studying them more, perhaps.
Yes.
And you can hear, I know this actor. I can recognize the voice in this show, and I can recognize the same voice in another show and
mm-hmm.
another show. Yet I don't think that radio audiences at the time were that analytical. I don't think they were so keenly aware of the actor. In fact, I think they were more aware of the character. And that's a great tribute to the actors.
Well, you also had doubles and triples and quadruples. Mm-hmm. In other words, the actors really could change their voices mm-hmm. and sound like different people. And one of them, Louis Van Ruten, had a show written for him especially where he did 23 different voices. And
oh
you really God. Couldn't tell which one was which. And Louis was, he was kind of an exceptional person. But you would think nothing of doing two and three different voices. And you'd do different accents. Everyone could do an Irish accent. Les Tremaine, for instance. Oh, could do a terrible, terrific Irish accent. And then you had you might have to come across with a bit of Scots. You see, you had to talk like a Scotsman, or you had to go into a nasal. Well, God blimey, what do you want now with this sort of thing, you know? And you had to talk like that, and you get on there, nobody knew who you were. So you could do all of these things. Yeah. Oh, there was another story, too. We were doing David Harum, which was an air features show. And we came into the studio one day, and we picked up the scripts, and we said, somewhere they screwed up. Well, see, air features were doing, I think, 21 or 22 shows in New York at that time. And the way the shows were done, they'd go into their files, and they'd pull out a script, and they'd get a writer, and they'd say, look, do this script, but change the name so it'll fit this show. And this is the way the shows were done. They just changed the names, and it was pretty much the same plot. So we figured that's what had happened. And the director came out and said, no, that's right, that's right. Well, what had happened was the writers had gotten so involved in the story, they didn't see how the hell they were going to get out of it, so they just dropped the whole plot line, started a whole new thing, and they didn't get one call. Nobody knew the difference. And there was another...
You have to wonder about what's happening to the audience at that moment.
Not a letter, not a phone call, nothing ever came through. We had another show, I think this happened in Chicago, Les probably remembers. It took them 8 weeks to get a guy through a revolving door. Yeah, you know... 8 weeks, the guy finally got on the other side, got into the building. It was a ridiculous
business.
Well,
that's the way the soap operas work. They had long recaps at the beginning of each episode, and a somewhat lengthy telling what's going to happen or what could happen or what do we have to watch out for.
Yeah.
And then, but you see, I believe that was because, first of all, I think they're filling time a little bit, but also... Yeah. The audience really couldn't be dependent to be there 5 days a week. I think people had other things to do. Sometimes they wouldn't be able to be there, so they would vamp a little bit so that you could pick it up.
Well, they were a very devoted audience, I'm sure, as you're aware. Excuse me. That the TV soap opera audience is nowhere near the numbers that they had in radio. Uh-huh. It's less than a quarter of what they used to have. These people are really devoted to the shows. I remember my wife was doing a show, Bunny. She was doing a part called Bunny Walters. She was playing a heavy on it in Chicago. Mm-hmm. And she went to a party. It was one of those parties, probably you were there, Les was probably there. The woman, the stripper, was there with pigeons. She had pigeons. And Les brought her to the, Les found her. Anyway... my wife was introduced first by her name, Fran Carlin, and then to this woman. And then they said, well, you know, she plays Bunny Walters on this soap opera. The woman attacked my wife because Bunny Walters was a villain, was a terrible person. And this woman attacked my wife, and they had to take the woman out of there and take her home. She believed
that much
implicitly
in
what was saying in the show.
I didn't take her home.
Bless, I wasn't going to mention that. Then there was another... what was another one of the... I don't know, there's so many stories about... Oh, there was another time. I was still doing Ma Perkins, but at the same time I happened to be doing something on a TV show. Mm-hmm. And Ethel... it was a show with Ethel Waters. And Ethel Waters, we were rehearsing, and all of a sudden, in the middle of this rehearsal for this TV show, Ethel Waters stopped everything. We had to stop and go listen to Ma Perkins. She listened to Ma Perkins every day, 5 days a week. And when she heard I was on Ma Perkins, I had to go into the dressing room with her and tell her about each one of these people as they came on the air. But every single day, she stopped the whole thing, whatever the rehearsal, wherever she was, and she had to listen to Ma Perkins. And that was the loyalty that those people had to radio soaps.
Wasn't a fantastic audience. Yeah. Casey, what are you doing today?
Well, today I happen to have parallel careers. While I was acting, and as you know, acting every once in a while has its low areas of income.
Yeah.
I also taught photography at New York University and was an adjunct professor of photography. So today I'm writing about it, and I do a column for a magazine on photography. And I teach photography every once in a while, but I also try to keep my wife contented because she's on Screen Actors Guild board, and she's AFTRA board, and she's still acting.
You mentioned your wife, Fran Carlin. Now, She was on Big Town and many radio shows.
Many in Chicago. Les knows more of the shows than I do that she was on. But actually, she started out here. The way she got into radio, she came out here to Fox as a starlet back in the 30s. That contract ran out. She drove a truck back to Chicago and went into the radio soaps and became one of the stars, I guess, of radio.
Sure. Absolutely. The name Fran Carlin is synonymous with
that. And then she replaced Claire Trevor. Claire Trevor and Edgar G. Robinson were doing Big Town out here. And it went to New York, and neither of them wanted to go, so she played Lorelei on Big Town, replaced Claire Trevor. And she's still at it.
She was the lovely Lorelei Kilborn.
Yep.
That's right. Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, she was supposed to be out here with me today, this week. And she's doing a commercial for Kmart.
No, well, I will have to see if we can get a blue light special and chat with her sometime.
Oh, yes. I think you'd find she'll tell you a lot about Les in Chicago, too.
Don't have
her on. Les Tremaine kibitzing in the background. Well, Casey, we appreciate you spending some time with us today.
Thanks.
Nice of you to,
and when you take that off, I'll tell you some other stories.
Oh, good. Thanks very much.
Right. Thank you.